we come upon this first anniversary. It's 36 months long, so we're 12 months into it. It's the first anniversary of it, and of this financial challenge that we're in. And I have to tell you, this is the most successful, most expansive financial challenge this church has ever done. We are in a pattern of doing these all the time. That's a part of our identity around here. It's really our vision, even these days. And I think it's a part of what our power and our strength is as a church. So there's a lot of stuff. Garrett's going to talk about it after I get done, about what we can do about that, and challenge, I think, some of you, of course, to participate in the deal. We are also going to wrap up with the Lord's table, communion today, and then we're going to have a, like Julie said, a big free feast. So to me, it's like, this is the perfect constellation of church going on today, you know, and reflecting back like on the early church, the first church, what we have is we worship, we are going to do the Lord's table, the symbol of feed on me, Christ says. We're going to have an agape feast. We're going to have our own meal. It's free, which is really cool. And we're going to, and everybody's giving away a bunch of money. Like, hey, we got the right thing going on today. You came in the right day. This is good. So my task, though, right now for the next few minutes is to remind us why. Why? Why would we want to do something like a financial challenge called As One? Why would we want to do all that stuff that we just watched on the video? So check me on this. Let's just start here. What do you think the number one goal on the planet is? So, you know, this is going to be big and way overstated. But what do you think the number one goal is for everybody on the planet? I'm going to propose it's contentment. Everyone is after contentment. Religious, religion, secular, pagan, doesn't matter. I think everyone's after contentment. Yes or no? What do you think? Everyone's after contentment? I mean, is that a broad enough statement? You know, we want our kids to be content. We want our households to be content. You want to be content in old age, have enough to live on, have your situation right, your health be good. You want to be safe. You want to have peace. Would that all be contentment? That's what we're all striving at. Matter of fact, just to take it to sort of a strange place, even people who have addictions, drug and drink or whatever it might be, they're seeking through their self-medication, especially early on, they're seeking some sort of contentment, right? I mean, everyone's, even if you do it wrong, the goal in life is contentment, I think is what I'm trying to say. Okay, people are trying to satisfy something deep within. They want peace of mind and in their soul. So if you agree with me that the goal in life is contentment, all right, then how do we become content? All right, I'm going to throw out then a big, huge spectrum, a scale, a sliding scale, you might say. And I'm going to polarize it. It's going to be a caricature, a little bit of a cartoon. But I'm going to start by saying, on one hand, if you want to gain contentment, you could do what the desert fathers and mothers did some 1,800, 1,700 years ago, early on in Christianity, out in the Egyptian desert. The monks, the desert hermit monks, fled the world. Now, what you have to understand, of course, is that the Roman persecution stopped around 314, thereabouts. And when the Romans stopped persecuting the Christians, then some Christians, you can take this for whatever it's worth, they kind of began to say, well, the world then is persecuting us. We need to flee the world. It's a sinking ship. It's full of evil. It's bent for hell. We need to get out of the world. And so they fled out in the desert. Because otherwise, we'll never be content as long as we're continuing with sin and compromise and all of this. All right? So on one hand, you have the monk thing. All right? That's one way of becoming content, is renounce the entire world. Renouncement, renunciation. Get rid of everything, and if you don't have anything, you'll be content, right? Because what's the old adage? It says, you know, if you want to be content, you can either, you know, get everything in the world, or you can have nothing. This would be the have nothing. On the other hand, it's the have everything, okay? On the other side of the spectrum would be this thing that is out there that says, you know what? You need to get your fair share, your piece of the pie, and chase it down. You need to work harder. You need to make something of yourself. You need to bring home the bacon, and you need to get ahead in life. This is what I would call, and it's not a very nice label, but it's called the accommodation. So on one hand, you have renunciation, renounce the world. On the other one, accommodate the world. Take in everything it has. Buy into it. Get yourself a good job, a good career. Get bigger and bigger and bigger. And you will be content if you have enough stuff and can buy anything you want and get anything you want. And you need to do pretty much whatever it takes to get there. It's only for the fit. They're the ones who survive on this deal. It's only for the aggressive and the assertive and the ones who make their own way. And by and large, I think these are sort of two poles, you know, and we could probably add a couple other axes here, but these are the two we're going to talk about this morning. So probably most of us are somewhere in the middle. As a matter of fact, I don't see too many people walking around here in robes on the monk thing, so we're probably leaning more towards this one of go out and get your fair share of the pie or the whole thing if you can. We're probably leaning more towards the accommodate the world as opposed to the renunciation. Now, if you're a deeply soulish, spiritual, Christian, Jesus-type person, you wonder what it's like to live the monastic life, but you're caught in this world, this environment that says, go out and get your own stuff. This competition and this compulsion to move ahead. Those are the two. I think for all of us who are probably in the middle here somewhere, leaning a little bit to the world side, for all of us, we're like, well, that's fine and dandy. But, you know, the monk thing is really hard. And the world thing sounds a little too grimy. What do we do? What are we supposed to do for all of us who are stuck in the middle? All right? Well, in walks the old Hebrew law, because economic and social justice was a big deal in the Old Testament. You're talking an agrarian society, and there were extreme poor, and there were a few rich, and so this was a big deal. So I'm going to give you three major ideas out of the Old Testament, out of the Hebrew law, the Torah, okay? And here's how the ancient Jewish law thought that everyone should be content. This is how we're going to gain contentment. First, there was something called Jubilee. And if you have your Bible or on your smartphone or whatever, if you have an app, it's out of Leviticus 25. At least that's a good starting place, Leviticus chapter 25. And you can sit there and read it instead of listening to me if you want. But I'll just sum it up for you. Here's the deal. Every 7 years of 7 years, 49 years, the 50th year was the Sabbath of years, and it was called the Jubilee year. And in that year, nobody really did anything. It was a huge celebration, and what happened was an economic redistribution. This was part of the law. So that if you had bought or sold land, particularly from somebody who was in distress, that land, every 50 years, reverted back to the original owner. If you had made loans, they were all canceled, and all debts were canceled, and everyone, you know, is the great Ali Ali Oxenfree thing, which is Hebrew for whoopee or something. I don't know, but, and then, like, if you had sold yourself to become an indentured servant, you know, you sold you and your family, which happened often in the ancient world. It wasn't necessarily always a bad thing, because you couldn't pay debts or whatever, and you just basically sold yourself to somebody. Then that was freed up too. Now, the idea here is that society was not to have either rich or poor. Everyone was supposed to be equal and fair. Okay? That was the idea in the Old Testament. No one's going to hoard. No one's going to do without. Everyone shall be content. All right? Everyone the same. Now, the American dream and our system of economics and so forth would really say, like, well, that's pretty and cute, but that's totally a farce. You know, economic socialism has been tried many times. It always falls apart, right? And we can all point to the communist experiment to see if that probably didn't turn out so well, at least not in the way it's panned out in the rest of the world in the last 100 years. And you know what? If the truth be told, the Hebrews didn't do Jubilee either. It was a big fantasy to them, too. They're like, yeah, right. I'm not canceling everybody's debt. You know, like some guy's trying to make a loan in the 49th year, you know, take out a loan. Like, what, the next year it gets canceled? I don't think so. So they never did it either. But hang on to it and don't miss the point, because the idea of fairness is coming from the mind of God. If God had his way, everyone would be content by being the same. Okay? And I know that kind of smacks into the whole American thing, but that's just the way it is. That's the first thing to remember, Jubilee. Second thing that the Hebrews practiced in their law was this idea of first fruits. First fruits, okay? The Hebrews did, however, observe first fruits, unlike Jubilee. They actually practiced it. What's first fruits? First fruits was a natural way to say thanks back to God. It was an act of gratitude. The very first of your crops, whether it be barley or wheat or pomegranates or olives or apples or whatever it was in the Holy Lands, the very first crop was given to the temple, was given to God. And a party ensued, and we're going to talk about that here in a moment. If you had a sheep or a goat, the very first animal birthed of that was given to God, was given away, okay? The first fruits thing was not so much the idea of a penalty that made everyone feel bad for getting something. The real idea, it was that it was supposed to spawn up inside of you an idea of like, it's not mine. Everything is a gift from God. I didn't do this. And the old term in the Old Testament is I didn't do this by the strength of my own arm, you know? You know what I mean? They're saying like, I didn't do it. It comes from the hand of God. So just to put this into our context these days, let's just say there's a guy with a cardboard sign at the top of the exit ramp, right? And he's asking for money or whatever, right? Panhandling. And we pull up and we say like, you know, I'm not going to give that guy a buck or $5 or something like that because he's just going to go out and buy drink with it. And I'm not going to be a part of that, you know? And in a sense, what we're doing is we're figuring out this guy's life for him and what his problem is, because obviously he has a problem as far as we're concerned. But you know what? In the idea of God, you just give them the money. Now, I know it's a complex deal about, you know, whether or not you're helping them and this sort of thing, but move past that just for a moment and keep it simple. The idea is that it's about you. So here's a really self-indulgent thing to do. Give the guy the buck or the $5 or whatever, because it's all about you and whether or not you can let go of your tight little white-knuckled fist and give away a buck. Good grief, you've got, on the other hand, a Starbucks worth $3.57. You know what I'm saying? So it's about you. And I had to go and wrestle through this for years, and I'm like, every time I give away money to a panhandler, and I know I'm going to get judged for that, and send me some email, okay? I won't answer. But is this idea of like, figure out what it feels like to let go of something. It's about you. Because you know what? He's got to stand before God someday, and you do too. So just think about it. What are you grateful for? And it's actually a freeing thing. You feel like you slayed some demon inside of you or whatever when you give something away. You're like, there, I did it. I gave away a dollar. I'm free. I'm very, very free. It's what happens inside of me. It's a really bizarre thing. Now, this first fruits thing, you can actually kind of get more... Well, make it more of an example, because around here, this has happened around here, people literally come and bring their very first fruits of their garden to Lakeland. They'll bring their peppers, their first tomatoes, and all of this stuff, and they'll bring it, and actually bring it, and I've seen it sitting in here and other places. They'll bring it in the office, say, hey, everybody take some of this, I, you know, this is my very first stuff. For me, it was like, you know, the very first basil you get in June, do we have anybody in here who knows what pesto is? You know what I mean? Any Italians, eh? You know what I mean? So, pesto, you know? I mean, with the Parmigiano Reggiano, you know, and that very first crop is always the best. And when the family sits down to have pesto, you know how painful it is to not use that for your first pesto? Instead, you bring it to the church? You're sacrificing something. You're saying to yourself, it's not for me. I never did this myself. And there's sort of a joy and a great gratitude that just comes with saying, like, I give it up. Everything comes from the hand of God. People bring in tomatoes, peppers, beans, and they resist the temptation to say, it's all mine. You know, it's all about me. And they've come to practice this and get it done. You know what you ought to do? And I'm not sure this is good Sabbath keeping, but, you know, Sabbath in Jewish laws on Saturday, so here we are, first day of the week. Go out this afternoon and start a garden. I don't care how lousy of a garden you start or whatever, but there's something, this is a spiritual metaphor. This is a discipline. You gardeners know this, and those of you who don't, you know, lean into this, because this is a torturous thing, starting a garden. It is a metaphor for your soul, because what's going to happen is you're going to go out and plant something after you got all dirty and did all this hard work and spent a bunch of more money than you're actually going to get back. But what's going to happen is in about 3 weeks, there's going to be aphids all over stuff. And you got to go out there and sweat and care for this stuff. And then it's not going to rain, or it's going to rain too much and you're going to get rotten. All of us, you're like, this is about my soul. Like, yeah, because what you have to do is connect with the land and the dirt and the soil and wait for rain from heaven and all the rest of this stuff that says, get yourself a garden and you'll watch yourself fret and worry. You know, like the couple last year, they started a garden about middle of summer. It all got stolen. Who steals somebody's vegetable garden? This guy said, like, he couldn't even speak for 3 days. He was so angry. You know, like, yeah. But you know what? You leave your sack of tomatoes sitting on the trunk of your car and drive off from Price Chopper, and you're like, oh, man, I got to go back and get some more tomatoes. None of this can't talk for 3 days thing. You know why you can't talk for 3 days? Because you grew it with your own hands. That's a powerful thing. So anyway, do what you want, but this afternoon, I'm going to be trying to dig up my garden. You should too. All right. Everything is a gift from God the giver, and we need to understand that our health, our heartbeat, our next breath, everything comes from God. We did not create ourselves on our own. And that's what First Fruits was trying to do. Here's the next biblical exercise to gain contentment, tithing. Tithe, the tithe. It means a tenth, and it comes from the Old Testament. Now, I know what you're thinking. You hear the word tithe, and everything tightens up, you know, and it sounds like a tax on fun. You know, tithe, isn't that a tax on fun? Like, isn't that just some sort of punishment that the church and religious people have come up with, you know? Like, isn't this some way for the church to find a way to fund all their fun ideas and for you to have less fun in the world and all this sort of deal? And our cynicism about the word tithing, what's great is, it's exactly the same attitude that the people had in Jesus' time. They thought it was a tax on fun too. They hated it. It was no good. You know why? Because the Pharisees, the religious leaders, had turned it into this completely burdensome, like a millstone around your neck activity. They had it down to an exact science. They'd take the idea of charity, first fruits, jubilee, and all the rest of this, and the idea of a tenth, and they had turned it into this big, huge, forced deal. As a matter of fact, Jesus accused them, like, you guys sort out your spices. You take your spice rack and you sort the thing out. You'll tithe even 10% out of your mint and your dill, but you ignore the basic charity that anybody would even give to their parents to take care of them. Like, and he's so angry with them because they live by the letter of the law instead of the spirit of the law. They didn't have charity in their hearts. They just had legalism, fundamentalism. And giving to God's work, when you get this idea, just becomes hellish. It's just a complete torture to people. Now, this idea of the tithe, though, goes all the way back to Abraham, way back in Genesis. Okay? This mysterious high priest named Melchizedek, there's a good word to have, Melchizedek, he shows up and visits Abraham right after Abraham had gone and rescued his nephew Lot. Remember Sodom and Gomorrah and that story and Lot and the pillar of salt and what's her name? She didn't even have a name anymore. She's just a pillar of salt. But nonetheless, these guys, Lot and everybody, gets carried off by these marauders, these armies that came together, and they carried off the whole city of Sodom and all the stuff. And Abraham says, that's not right. I'm going to go rescue my nephew. So he takes off with his guys, and they go out and they rescue the stuff, and these marauders had all this bounty, you know, that they'd been collecting. And now it's all Abraham's because he kicked their butt. And what happened is that night Melchizedek shows up and he's this high priest of God. And Abraham says, in celebration of what happened, Melchizedek, I'm giving you a tenth of everything we got. It's not mine. He gives, by the way, the other 90% to this other king. And so they could have a big, huge party. The whole idea of the tithe was to have a party. It was to have a party. Okay? And let me tell you what we're talking about here on this sort of thing. This is out of Deuteronomy chapter 14, so you can look that up if you want. But Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 24 through 27 says this. This is what they're supposed to do when they get a bunch of money. Now, when the Lord your God blesses you with a good harvest, as long as the harvest went well, the place of worship he chooses for his name to be honored might be too far for you to bring your tithe. In other words, if it's like a 3-day walk, your stuff's going to spoil. All right? So here's what you do if it's too far for you to travel. Everybody had to walk or ride a donkey or something back then. If so, you may sell the tithe portion of your crops and herds, put the money in a pouch, in your wallet, go to the place the Lord your God's chosen. When you arrive there, you may use the money to buy any kind of food you want, cattle, sheep, goats, wines, alcoholic drink. then feast there in the presence of the Lord your God and celebrate with your household. That means everybody, your workers and everything. Oh yeah, and then here's this last verse, verse 27. And do not neglect the Levites in your town, for they will receive no allotment of land among you. Remember that Israel is divided into 12 clans, 12 tribes. One of them were the Levites, and they were the priests, and they took care of the temple, and they didn't own any land. So when you brought stuff, you know, animals and stuff like that, and sacrificed and tithes, that's how they and their clan all got fed. Okay? So that's the way that worked. But, and by the way, you know, we really don't have Levite priests in a temple or anything anymore, but we do have pastors. And I think if I read this last verse right, it says don't neglect those guys. And so the next time you're having a party, if you happen to know any pastors in your life, just if you'd happen to know any, I like Diet Dr. Pepper, Code Red Diet, okay, with all the caffeine, and maybe a Boulevard Pilsner and wheat, not ill. Anyway, I'm just saying, invite those people in. Have a party. That's what it was all supposed to be about. It was supposed to be a big party. It was a celebration. It wasn't a drag. It wasn't supposed to be a tax on fun. It was supposed to be the money to have fun. It was supposed to be a huge celebration. Go out and blow the money. Now, you don't just do it by yourself, which is a very American thing to do, you know. You do it with your friends and you do it in community. It was a very formal sort of a deal to say, we are going to do this together. It's a very intentional party. Okay? And you can see where communion sort of comes out of this whole idea. And always with communion, the very first church, there was always a big feast with it too, which had really practical reasons because the poor would come too. Okay? And everyone would get fed. Have a party. Don't miss the point, everyone. Money and possessions are all from the hand of God. They are meant to be enjoyed. They are not meant to be hoarded. They are not meant to be a competition or a compulsion. They are not meant to cause you anxiety and worry. I'll say it again. Money is not meant to cause you anxiety and worry. We are to live one day at a time. Money was meant to be a free thing and a thing to enjoy life. And one of the worst things we can ever do in the spiritual life is load it up with a lot of burden. Instead, the freedom to be able to give money was be able to set us free and make us content. Contentment comes through living loose to hoarding. I get the same look from everybody for 16 years that I'm getting right now from everyone that says, dude, you're talking gibberish. But believe me, I have experienced this. You will never be more free and more powerful than when you figure out how to not just live on less, but be able to give away significant amounts of money and possessions to other people who have less. You will slay a dragon so big, and you will be free. I wish I could talk you into it. We turn the last corner and we move out of the Old Testament and we move to the New Testament, to the words of Jesus. And here's what Jesus said in his great big sermon. Look at the birds. They don't plant or harvest or store food in barns, for your heavenly Father feeds them. Aren't you far more valuable to him than they are? And then here comes these great words. Can all your worries add a single moment to your life? You know this, right? Can all your worries about money and getting ahead and security and everything else, will it really add a moment to your life, a single moment? No, but medical science these days says it'll sure take it away. Stress is a killer. Heart disease and hypertension and whatever else, I don't know what I'm talking about. Will it add a single moment to your life? No. No, it won't. All the compulsions of life tell us to be very, very, very worried. And Jesus walks in and says, one day at a time, each day has enough worries of its own. Just live with enough worries for one day. That's all you need. I challenge you on this grand experiment. Sure, we are getting a lot of cool stuff done with AS1, and that's great because it's all real smart. But there's another part of it where it sets us free. And that's the real experimental part. It is a spiritual exercise to say, I am not going to be a slave. It doesn't matter about the amount. It matters about the practice. And that's, for me these days, this is why we do these financial challenges. I think it's the most powerful spiritual training exercise we could ever do. This will be our thanksgiving to God and our prayer. The 23rd Psalm, probably arguably the most famous piece of passage in all of Scripture. And this will be our thanksgiving for the food we're about to have and for the feast. And also just say back to God, it's not us, it's all you. Would you recite this with me, pray this with me, declare this to yourself and to your neighbor right now, all of us all together, join me. The Lord is my shepherd. I have all that I need. He lets me rest in green meadows. He leads me beside peaceful streams. He renews my strength. He guides me along right paths, bringing honor to his name. Even when I walk through the darkest valley, I will not be afraid, for you are close beside me. Your rod and your staff protect and comfort me. You prepare a feast for me in the presence of my enemies. You honor me by anointing my head with oil. My cup overflows with blessings. Surely your goodness and unfailing love will pursue me all the days of my life, and I will live in the house of the Lord forever. And we all said, Amen.